This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, part of the Seneca Network from SUP China. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I'm your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series, and every time someone starts a statement with, "I'm no genius," I know that I'm only going to agree with that first part. My co-host is John Pazden, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese grammar wiki, Sinosplice.com, and almost dropped his phone on a soft, carpeted floor, but luckily has lightning-fast reflexes and was able to slap it into the wall instead. Shanghai and Beijing are the two biggest cities in China with strong reputations. In this episode, we're going to talk about the rivalry between the two cities, something you'll appreciate even greater if you've been to either. Guest interview is with William White, a professional simultaneous interpreter in Chinese with decades of experience and stories. All this and more, let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared coming at you from Utah in the United States.
Hi guys, I'm John Pazden and I am in hot, humid Shanghai. How's it going?
Okay, John, our episode today is inspired by a listener email. This comes from Inari Porca. I hope I'm saying her name correctly, but she is a listener of our podcast and she picked up on something, and I'll take the snippet from her email. She says, "What is up with Beijing and Shanghai? Do they like hate each other? Is there a friendly rivalry? What's going on?" If you can shed any light on this, I'd really appreciate it. All right. So Inari, let's go ahead and address this topic, Shanghai versus Beijing. All right, let's first, I will say my experience. I've been to Beijing, I think, four times on different trips, different lengths of time. I haven't lived there, but I have a number of friends who have. John, what's your experience with Beijing?
So I've been there many times. I've had lots of friends living there. I've never lived there long term, no more than like a week or so.
All right, there you go. And Shanghai, I lived in Shanghai for 8 years. And John, how many years are you going now?
like 18. I'm hitting 21 years in China, like right around now.
Yeah, you're like serving a life sentence here at this stage. So
it's a very enjoyable vacation. That's what it is.
Always an adventure. That's what it always says. Must have been an adventure. Like, oh yeah, every day, not mundane. Always an adventure. I say that tongue in cheek, really. But okay, but I will say this, well, straight up, there is some sort of, I don't know, John, how would you classify this? A rivalry or some between the two cities?
Yeah, I think it's fair to make a comparison between like LA and New York in the US, right? There are differences and there is a little bit of animosity. Although I've been talking with friends about this as preparation for this podcast. And one thing that a lot of people have noticed, people that are here in China, in Shanghai and Beijing, they've noticed that the animosity seems to have faded a bit in recent years, but I remember it used to be stronger.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I've heard people from Shanghai speak disparagingly about people in Beijing, and I've heard the exact same thing of people from Beijing speaking disparagingly towards those in Shanghai. So yeah, there is something there, but let's go and unpack this a little bit. And even though things might have died down, there's still definitely some stuff there. I think it's more of like a sports team rivalry, you know? That's kind of how I think about it.
Well, one thing that you'll notice, and I noticed this most like obviously when I was working at Chinese Pod around 2008, and we tried to find someone from Beijing in Shanghai to be a co-host for an advanced podcast. And it was just so hard to find anyone from Beijing and Shanghai. And I think that's true to this day. And when you go to Beijing, you just don't find that many Shanghainese living there.
Yeah, I think this is something that's really important because like I've done a lot of business in Shanghai in my 8 years there. I've worked on consulting projects. I've done, you know, some deals. I've done on a lot of just projects and with my own business there. And it's very rare if I ever run into someone in Shanghai who is from Beijing. Like I've met some people who've lived there, but the actual people who I've met or worked with or that I've known of who, and this is something that comes up common, right? Because they always kind of ask, where are you from? And you know, really most people in Shanghai are not native Shanghainese. They are, you know, born in different areas,
I mean, if you look at the population statistics of Shanghai, you know, 20 years ago, I mean, it was, I don't know the population, but it certainly wasn't the 24 million it is today. Most people, you say, are transplants. You know, they've come from out there and you come into the big city for jobs and for work. So, yeah, you get that. And also, I think, John, in my interactions with and being in Beijing and different projects and things I've worked on, I have met very few people in Beijing who are from Shanghai. And I can only remember, like, honestly, a couple times where I've had friends or I've known someone who has gone to Beijing from Shanghai for, like, job or work or something like that.
Yeah, even foreigners, they tend to land in one camp and kind of stay there. So I think what we should do next is we want to give a quick rundown of the differences between the two cities, whether you're planning to come to China for a visit when this whole COVID thing is under control, or whether you have plans to live in China for some reason. It's just useful to get this comparison because these are the two big cities that most people consider when they're going to China, Beijing and Shanghai. Okay, so we have a number of things that we're going to cover. We're just going to make a few comments about each. So first of all is the physical space. So Beijing is massive. I remember when I was in Beijing on a trip and I was looking at the map and I was looking at where I needed to go. And I didn't like look at the scale and I was just thinking, it's not that far. Maybe I'll just walk. But then I was like, could be late. I don't want to be late. So I got in a taxi and I ended up in the taxi for like 45 minutes and we were not stuck in traffic. It was so far. Beijing is so big and downtown Shanghai is really quite small.
Yeah, I will concur on that. I do recall my first time to Beijing and looking at that map, right? And you see a city block and I'm like, oh yeah, it's maybe just like two blocks down the road. Oh my goodness. Those city blocks are massive. I mean, they're huge. And in Beijing, they got the hutongs, and those are like the back alleys through the massive city blocks. And so it's like, yeah, the scale of just, I don't know about the scale, but just it's like how this things are laid out. It's just much bigger there in Beijing. But yeah, Shanghai, I mean, you can kick it around your little stomping grounds, your neighborhood, you know, and you can get around.
Well, in Shanghai, like so many times I'm waiting for a cab and it's like not coming or whatever, especially before DD. And rather than just keep waiting, I'll just start walking. And a lot of times I'll end up getting there a lot quicker than I thought just because I walked it. But that's something that you just can't do in Beijing.
That's right. Now, I will say real quick, I'll take a side note for the efficacy of bicycles and scooters. Yes, those are much quicker ways to get around frequently than a taxi.
One other note, though, because downtown Shanghai is small, there's been this add-on, which is Pudong, which is the area across the river. And so that is pretty massive, the international airports over there. But a lot of us, when we talk about Shanghai and what's cool about Shanghai, we're not talking about Pudong. We're talking about downtown Shanghai, the older region.
Yeah, and I got to say, we could also make a whole nother podcast about the two sides of Shanghai, the Pudong and Puxi, right? It's the east and west side of the river. They're like two different camps, right?
Nothing interesting about Pudong. All right, moving on. Moving on. The next point is history. So I think this is pretty obvious. Like Beijing has tons of history. So you talk about Beijing, you know, Great Wall, the Forbidden City, Temple of Heaven, Summer Palace, like all these really famous, culturally rich places that you can visit in Beijing. It's like a tourist, heaven if you're into China. Whereas Shanghai, like there's this bund along the river where you can see a pretty skyline. But as far as like history, Shanghai has a pretty short history.
That is absolutely true. Now, there are some cool museums there in Shanghai, but you just don't get that rich, you know, Chinese culture. You actually get a lot more foreign culture, like foreign historical culture in Shanghai. We have the former French concession in some of those buildings, even the Bund, right? Those are like, those are more Western architecture buildings that are built along the river there in Shanghai. And so it's not Chinese culture per se, it's more Western culture that was built back in the 1920s and 30s of Shanghai.
Yeah, so the 1920s and 30s in Shanghai are pretty cool. It's just that they were only 100 years ago, whereas Beijing, you know, you got plenty of stuff that goes back hundreds of years.
So, all right, so there's definitely that cultural element.
All right, but then on the topic of culture. So Beijing is often called China's cultural center with good reason. Like, you'll find so many artists and musicians and, you know, all kinds of artists there. There's great tech innovation, like lots of startups come out of Beijing. A lot of people think of Beijing as the authentic China, whereas Shanghai is more commercial, has a lot of stuff, a lot of interesting things, but it's much more modern. So it's like the modern China.
Yeah, so I think this is a good comparison to note on. Like, Shanghai, like, it, commerce center, absolutely. Like, all, like, the big, like, foreign corporations that are in China, I mean, the vast majority of them have their headquarters in Shanghai. Not a lot will have their headquarters in Beijing. They may have an office in Beijing for maybe, you know, government relations or something, but it's also just a big city. There's a lot of, you know, market opportunity there in a business sense. But they're in Shanghai, yeah. I'll give a good story about this, John. Once I had a friend of mine from business school who was big into investing. And he was investing in these Chinese companies that are on the New York Stock Exchange. And one day he sent me, he says, "Hey, Jared," he sent me a link to this company, and that was a Chinese company. He'd invested some money into it. And he's like, "Jared, can you take a look at this? And you think this is a legit company?" And so I looked at their website, and they sold like advertising on public transport or something. And I went looked through all the different details about it. But then right away, I saw something, John, and I knew it was a fraud.
What?
Their headquarters was somewhere in Anhui, in some town I'd never heard of. And this company had claimed to do business with all like these big multinationals and Fortune 500 companies in China. And I knew right away, as soon as I saw like their headquarters was like in this town that I'd never heard of, I'm like, it's fake. Absolutely fake. If they're going to be doing business in China on any type of scale that they're talking about, they have to have their headquarters in Shanghai. They have to be there because that's where the center of commerce is.
Mm. International, yeah. Like global focused companies. Yeah.
Oh, and spoiler alert, the company was fake and he lost a lot of money. So so that was a really interesting story. But on the Beijing side, what are we going to find in Beijing?
So like, for example, if you're into live music, there's just a lot more in Beijing. If you're into, literature, there's a lot more people like getting together to talk about books and stuff. If you're an artist, you know, you want to see like really cutting edge, interesting art, there's just a lot more. Of that kind of activity going on. And you still have that in Shanghai. It's just Beijing. It's just buzzing. There's just so much of it.
So case in point, Kaiser Guo, who is, you know, the managing editor of Sup China, he started the first heavy metal rock band in China in Beijing. It's Tang Dynasty was the name of the man. So there you go.
All right, so let's keep going. One thing that's quite kind of relevant to culture is politics. So obviously Beijing being the capital of China is a very political place. People talk about politics a lot more. They care about politics a lot more. Whereas Shanghai, guess what? They're a little more focused on business and money. I don't know. That sounds kind of mean, but it's so true. Sorry.
Yeah.
Maybe not everybody, but
I agree.
There's this expression in Chinese that we translate as heaven is high and the emperor is far away. Right. So that applies to Shanghai and not Beijing, right?
That's right. Yeah. This is something I've definitely noticed about Shanghai is like everyone's got an idea. If you could think about, at least I can speak from an American perspective, like going to New York City to make it, right? A lot of people will try to get to Shanghai for a job to, you know, go make it out there. But not just that, it seems like everyone's got an idea. I mean, everyone's got, you know, aspirations to start their own business.
You mean a business idea?
Yeah, yeah. They got their business idea or something they want to start and something they want to go out there and make millions of dollars or millions of RMB because they've known people who've done it or they see people who've done it. And it can be crazy. I've known guys, I've got friends who, you know, Chinese and foreign friends in Shanghai who have made it big, you know, made a company and end up raising $50 million or went, I know a friend of mine who went public, you know, with his business and he's making tons of money. And so people see that and a lot of that stuff kind of happens in Shanghai and there's all those investors and money and stuff floating around. And so a lot of people, it attracts a lot of that stuff, that entrepreneurial spirit and people want to start things.
Meanwhile, people who are interested in things like foreign policy and journalism focused on politics, those people gravitate much more heavily towards Beijing. They get closer access to not being allowed in anywhere. But anyway, they get to talk to people about politics a lot more because it's just, you know, a part of the city.
Absolutely. And so something also to think about is, I think, you know, John, you're kind of putting like the LA, New York kind of concept, but I think it'd almost be a little bit like of New York versus like some sort of mix between LA and Washington, D.C., because the center of government is there in Beijing. And this is also one of the things about China is that there's more rule of man versus rule of law. They do have a lot of laws, don't get me wrong, but a lot of them can be written a little bit arbitrarily that allow the person in power to arbitrarily decide how they're going to be applied. And that kind of applies even much higher in the government. So you got a lot of people over there who, you know, the Guanxi concept of just, you know, connections, you know, as we would, maybe if you're in a democratic country, the concept of lobbying, well, absolutely. That concept of lobbying happens in China, and a lot of it's going to happen in Beijing. And so you get a little bit more of that political nature because there's a lot of people in positions of power there.
Okay, so two more really important points I want to cover before we have a special surprise. So next up is the food. Why don't you start this one, Jared? Food.
Okay, well, the food, yes. I can speak about this specifically in Shanghai. As I've mentioned before on this podcast, I've started a bakery, a cinnamon roll bakery called Cineswirl in Shanghai, and I was very much involved in the food scene over there. The big thing about Shanghai is that it's a very international food scene, especially within the last 10 years. It has just really exploded. I mean, you got restaurants of all different types. You got a lot of entrepreneurs in the food and beverage business there. Not just that, just there's all sorts of different types of bars and clubs, distributions of food. A lot of guys have kind of set up factories in the area, so you can get a lot of stuff imported into that area. So you can just get there's a whole bunch of like a robust aspect of like international food there. But I think what's really cool, John, is just and you're going to get this in a lot of places around China, but you also getting, you know, Chinese food. And if anyone who knows any has been to China and they knows a little bit about the Chinese cuisine, is that it's very diverse, right? I mean, every different region has got their different style of food, and you can get all of that in Shanghai too. But what I think is really cool is the fusion cuisine that I've seen. Is sometimes there's merging of different types of Chinese cuisine and merging of Chinese cuisine with international concepts or flavors and everything like that. So I would say the food scene, it's very dynamic. It's also very cutthroat. I mean, it's kind of here today, gone tomorrow. Sometimes things can turn over really fast, but it's really cool and dynamic what's going on over there in the food scene in Shanghai.
All right, so let me talk about Beijing a little bit. I think one of the things Beijing has going for it is that it's not Shanghai. And the thing that Chinese people and foreigners alike dislike about Chinese food in Shanghai is that often there's a lot of sugar added. So especially the local Shanghainese food, it tends to be on the sweet side. And like when you have like a banquet with like 10 dishes and they're all sweet, it's kind of annoying. Beijing is not quite as international as Shanghai, I would say, but I think it's plenty international. Maybe Shanghai is a little bit more, like international for you foodies. I'm not really a foodie. I always ate really well in Beijing, and I appreciate the fact that the food isn't all sweet. In fact, if I ever want to kind of bond with northerners in China, I'll just complain about how Shanghainese food is too sweet, and they'll be like, yes, thank you. You know, it's really true.
I got to put a caveat on that, John, that the food in Shanghai is sweet. That's relative. So, you know, if you are an American and you go to Shanghai and you're expecting like sweet food, you're going to be disappointed. You're like, this isn't sweet, right? This isn't like, you know, lemon chicken or orange chicken or something sweet, right?
But to give an example, all right, like Sichuanese food is popular all over China. And if you order Kung Pao chicken in Shanghai, it's often kind of sweet. It's not supposed to be sweet, but in Shanghai, they adapt it for the local population. Whereas you go to Beijing, you order this Kung Pao chicken, is not going to be sweet. So that's just a simple example. And of course, both places have their famous dishes, you know, Beijing roast duck, you know, jiajangmian, kind of noodle, all this other stuff. Shanghai has their soup dumplings and their, what else do they have in Shanghai? You can look that up. But aside from the sugar thing, I think both are good. All right, one more thing I want to get to before we have a special audio clip is language, which is what this podcast is all about. So people often ask me, like, oh, if I want to study Chinese, like, I need to go to Beijing, right? I can't go to Shanghai. I've heard they have accents there. And so, yes, it is true that the Beijing accent is the basis of the standard Chinese accent. But if you talk to the old Beijingers, sometimes their accent gets a little out of control. No, it's not out of control. It's just being very local, which goes beyond the standard. So it's not always 100% standard, especially if you want to get into the really slangy stuff or the stuff that old people speak. But it's definitely closer to the standard. And you're going to have a lot more of that R, the pirate speak, as people like to say.
Darn, Zainar.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas in Shanghai, there are plenty of people that speak standard Mandarin and plenty of people that don't. There's also the local Shanghainese so-called dialect, which is kind of a separate language. And you do hear that, but it's not like that's all you hear. You hear Mandarin all around you, and you hear both standard and non-standard Mandarin. So for me, as a linguist, I found it really interesting to be able to hear standard and non-standard, and I had to like actively train myself to be aware of what was standard and what was not. And then when I go to Beijing, it's like, oh, so easy to understand, as long as they don't bust out too much slang. And so, yeah, I think they're both good language-wise.
I will say I can usually identify when someone is from Beijing. You know, when you hear that Arhua, you're like, oh, are you from Beijing? And if they're not from Beijing, they're from, you know, Dongbei, you know, which is going to be the northeast region.
Yeah, and it's not only the R's, but there's also kind of a lilt to the language. And it's cool. So you'll definitely want to visit both places if you can, when you can. Okay, next up, we're going to try something different. We have an audio clip from a friend of mine. This is someone who lived in Beijing for a long time. It's someone whose voice you may recognize, but I'm not going to tell you who it is. If you write in, you might be able to guess who it is, and we'll acknowledge you on the show. But we're going to have this audio clip next.
And I would like to say, I think this is a pretty, you know, a balanced view of someone from Beijing. And John, I think this is supposed to be a pretty balanced view of someone from Beijing about Shanghai. So let's listen.
So John has asked me to say something nice about Shanghai. And I got to admit, I kind of struggled with this a bit because, you know, we all know the problems with Beijing. It's a physical desert. It's polluted. It's kind of inhuman in a lot of ways. You know, Shanghai is a spiritual desert, and we've got to own up to that. With that said, you know, it's getting better. It's not true that Shanghai is totally without culture. You know, it used to have the most Starbucks and pretty much the least bookstores of any city in China, but that's changing. You used to be able to walk down the street in Shanghai with a book and people would stop and ask you, what is that? But that's not true anymore. These days, people have seen books on TV. Shanghai's also getting better, the food scene. It used to be super hard to get a good meal after 9, but, you know, you guys have a Tackalicious now. And as long as you avoid eating at a restaurant that serves Shanghainese food, you can get a decent meal. So where are we with everything else? Everyone knows Shanghai has been cruising on the entire jazz era thing for a while. It's a bit tiresome, but we're getting past that. The city is starting to get a reputation for other things. I asked a friend of mine what she thought the other day, and she said, Shanghai you qian ren gong tuo. And, you know, you got to take that. Just go with it, guys. There's a lot happening in Pudong too, so much that it's easy to forget that in the Qing Dynasty, people would crawl over to that side of the river to die. And I think we've all felt like that at times. But yeah, you know, Shanghai's improving. And, you know, part of this is admitting that life up north is a bit overrated. There's a lot of things about Beijing that are kind of hard. People want to take breaks. And I think that's why people sometimes do take vacations. And they'll travel down to Shanghai to give their lungs a break and to re-experience the joy of leaving the city. So, yeah, you know, I've got pet peeves. The taxi driver situation is a bit weird. It's kind of odd that nobody in Shanghai can pronounce the name of their city, but it could be worse. You guys could be living in Tianjin.
Well, that was a little unexpected, John.
Oh, man, I love this guy. All right, let's make a few comments on what he said.
Okay, there's one thing he said that was really accurate, is that back in, you know, one of those dynasties, people would crawl over to Pudong to die. So, I mean, yeah, that can still happen today, I guess.
It was a swamp back then, so good place to die. but a few things. So he said Shanghainese people can't even pronounce the name of their city. So in the Shanghainese accent, rather than saying Shanghai, they would say Sanhai. So, or in Shanghainese, Zanghe. So anyway, it's... that's kind of funny, but anyway, they use their own language. And then he said, 有钱人更多. So he was saying that there are more rich people in Shanghai. I don't know the stats on that, but I guess.
It might be true.
It might be true. and finally, he addressed a point which we kind of skipped over in the beginning, which was kind of the weather and the pollution. So Beijing has famously had a huge problem with pollution. It's definitely gotten better in recent years. Shanghai started getting really bad, but then it also got better. But I think over all this, Beijing has been worse. But actually, neither place has very good weather, I got to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Shanghai, it's either going to be hot and sticky or chilled to the bone.
Yeah, cold and wet.
And Beijing?
So Beijing gets cold, but it's dry, and the indoor heating is really good. But it's also really hot in the summer. But I've had people that lived in the north of China through the winter come to Shanghai, spend the winter here, and be like, I've never been so cold in my entire life. Like even though the temperature doesn't get that cold, like the indoor heating situation isn't as good, and the wetness just chills you to the bone.
Yeah, this is one thing I've noticed a difference. I've done a lot of trips up to Dongbei region in the northeast of area of China, and this includes Beijing, and they have insulation in their homes and in the buildings. Shanghai does not. They're just like concrete blocks. And when it gets cold outside, those walls and floors cool down, and they just turn your whole like apartment into an ice box. I mean, it's just cold. I mean, you turn on the heater and it just heats up the air, but you turn it off and you're instantly cold again, and you can never like get warm. So anyway, that's one of my frustrations about Shanghai.
That is true. Okay, but anyway, both are great cities. People tend to end up liking one or the other. I actually would really like to go back to Beijing for a visit, because I haven't been in years and I have a good friend there. The Great Wall, man. I love the Great Wall. I got to say that. I don't think Shanghai has any tourist attractions that I love, but the Great Wall is one tourist attraction that does not disappoint.
Oh, you can go up the Pearl Tower.
Yeah.
Boo.
And the new tallest building in the world, or in Asia? Tallest building in Asia? Whatever that's called.
Yeah.
I keep forgetting. Cool. Yeah. Shanghai Tower?
I think it's slowly sinking. One day it might not be, but anyway. Yeah, but it is for now. So it's the second tallest building in the world. It's the Shanghai Tower. In fact, right there, all three buildings, you got the Shanghai Tower, the World Financial Center, and the Jinmao Tower are all in the top 10 tallest buildings in the world. All next
Yay.
Week.
Yay. Cool. Can't say it really makes Yay. Shanghai a better place to live. But anyway, my family's here, so I'm always going to be kind of comfy in Shanghai. But this topic really will never end. You can just go on and on forever.
Absolutely. And I got to say, though, that these are just, they're amazing cities. Bottom line, if you've never been to Shanghai, you've never been to Beijing, they're both amazing cities. And it when you actually come, it can blow your concept of what you think this country and this city might be. But I also do this, I do recommend to people that don't judge a country based on it's just its biggest city. You know, and that's one of the takeaway I'd like to give to anyone coming here, is that I've got people that come to Shanghai, some family members, friends, and they're like, oh, wow, China's amazing. And I'm like, Shanghai's amazing, but this is not China. It's a very diverse place, cities, towns, provinces all over the place. I remember it's got 1.4 billion people.
Wait, the rest of China isn't amazing at all. Is that what you're trying to say? Different flavors of
it's
amazing.
It's also amazing. It's just like, don't come to the biggest city and just say, oh, yeah, I've seen China. No, you've seen the city. And if you have the opportunity, travel around the beautiful country of China. There's so much to see, so much to do, and your opportunities are endless. And if you speak Chinese, John,
it's even better.
That's right. All right, now it's time for a word from our sponsor. And today our sponsor is...
ARC by All Set Learning.
Is this like Noah in the Ark?
Different ARC. So ARC stands for Advanced Readings in Chinese. It's a newsletter. It is free. And the whole idea is if you're at an upper intermediate or advanced level and you just want to save some time finding interesting things to read which aren't too long, then sign up for this newsletter. Once a week, we'll send out a selection of little snippets from the news, pieces about social trends and developments, a joke, an image, and it's just a nice collection. It's mostly simplified, but there's a little bit of traditional in there too.
So, John, is this going to cost me any money for this?
It is free, Jared. Zero money.
Oh, wow. That is great. Where can I go sign up for this wonderful free resource?
All right. So we'll put a link in the show notes, but it's allsetarc.substack.com.
Oh, that is so wonderful, John. I am so excited about this. I think I'm going to go sign up right now.
Wait a second, Jared. You got to be advanced. Are you ready?
Oh, I think so. I think I can handle it.
This is roughly...
Let me at least try.
Roughly level 8 on the Mandarin Companion skill. I don't know. It's not level 3, but it's up there. You definitely want to be advanced.
All right. So go check out the link in the show notes, and you can sign up for that newsletter today.
And we would love it if you give us some feedback on how you like it.
All right, now it's time for rants and raves. John, what do you have for us today? Do you have a rant or do you have a rave?
I have a rave. And today, since we were talking about Beijing and Shanghai, I couldn't help but mention another place in China. This is somewhere that I went for vacation this year. No leaving China right now. So my family and I, in July, we went to a place called Yangshuo, which is near Guilin in southern China, Guangxi province. And it is so awesome. It has rock climbing, caving, hiking, mountain biking, swimming, lots of outdoor stuff, and the natural scenery is just amazing.
Wow, Yangshuo, I've been there before. It's pretty awesome. Usually people, when they say, I'm going to Guilin, they actually mean Yangshuo, right?
Yeah, because there's lots of day trips you can do from Guilin, but I find it's better just go to Yangshuo, stay there.
And what is it, was it on the 5 or 10 RMB note? It's got a scenic picture of Yangshuo?
I think it's the 20. Yeah, so those beautiful mountains, the ones that are frequently featured in like mystical-looking China, like, I don't know, Kung Fu Panda has them. I think some of the mountains in Avatar, you know, James Cameron's Avatar, have them. Anyway, amazing scenery, really beautiful. All right, so Jared, what do you have, rant or rave?
John, I have a rave. Now, I have been listening to some other podcasts recently, and one podcast that I've started listening to, and I've really enjoyed it, and I wanted to recommend it to anyone out there. It's the China in Africa podcast. Now, it is part of the SubChina Network, but, you know, hey, this is pretty cool. A lot of people may not be aware of how involved China is in Africa, but man, they are big time players and investors in things that are going on in China. And so this podcast, it's been going for like 12 years, a long, long time. The guy who's been doing the podcast, his name is Eric Olander, and he's got a co-host, it's Dr. Corbis van Staden. And anyway, these guys are like, you know, everything about China in Africa, and they know their stuff. And it's been really interesting. And they're talking about current events, just investments, different things that are happening in China that China's behind. So if you're interested in politics, geopolitical stuff, China watching, this type of things, this would be an interesting podcast. I'd recommend have a listen. It's really cool.
Great. And you can check out the other stuff on SubChina while you're at it.
Oh, I think I'm going to go do that right now.
Go.
My name's William White, and I'm an interpreter. I do various things. You'll understand that I'm not allowed to mention a few of them, NDAs and the like, but you could also find pictures of me with politicians occasionally and in some other funny situations.
William is the type of guy, if you met him, you'd never suspect he has such a high level of Chinese. I like how he's continued to hone his skills, which opened up a world of opportunity for him. And I also learned quite a bit about the difference between interpreting and translating. Stay with us. Why did you start learning Chinese?
Well, here's the thing. I didn't know what to do after university. And That was partly because the subject I'd been doing at university had felt more and more like just a day job, just going through the motions. I did law at university. And I couldn't really think of anything else. So instead of that, this idea suddenly came to me of going to Beijing and spending a year learning Chinese and just seeing what happened. But the idea had come from somewhere, which is that before university, I'd spent half a year in Hong Kong.
Oh.
Half a year in Hong Kong working for somebody who was, to some extent, part of the system, if you like. This was pre-1997 Hong Kong.
So for listeners, pre-1997, that's when the British were still had, I guess, what, control over Hong Kong?
Yeah, it was still a British colony at that time. And I didn't pick up any Cantonese while living there. But I did get to go on a couple of business trips to mainland China. And that was a very different environment. This was 1994, 95. Acoustically, visually, I've heard other people that you've interviewed say that it was like being a baby. Mm-hmm. You can't read, write, even feed yourself. But also it was maybe the first truly different place I'd been to. You know, you would see things like people squatting, you know, people would sit differently. And just a lot of stuff I didn't understand, so I was curious. And when the chance came to go back and find some things out, I took it.
Was there anyone else, like, yeah, in your boat who had done anything like this similar?
It was a stroke of luck in a way. I'd asked around a little bit at university. There's a couple of academics who had mainland Chinese backgrounds, and I asked them, well, where should I go? Where might I be able to sign up for something like this for a year learning Chinese? And one of them said BLCU, the ex-BLI, Beijing Language Institute. But it was a stroke of luck going there at this particular time, just because of the area of town it was in, next to Tsinghua in an area called Wudaokou, where the punk scene was just in its heyday.
The punk scene? Punk scene, now tell me about this.
Now, by most accounts, Wudaokou is where it started in Beijing. There was a club in Wudaokou Market, which was basically very squat brick buildings, and I think it was all mud roads, and you had to wander in and take a few turns before you'd find this place. But it was called Scream Club, Haojiao Julebu, which is where some of the major bands started. And I won't claim to have been a major part of the punk scene, but I stayed in touch with a few people there. I also had quite a gregarious flatmate. There was this another spontaneous thing that happened. After a month in a hotel room, I was just randomly introduced to somebody who needed to find a flat, and she was from Fujian. So spoke with a pretty thick accent, but importantly, there would be a constant stream of guests coming in all the time. So that was a way to just strip my inhibitions away, because there would always be people in the living room when I came back home. We had no table at the beginning. We had one of these things that you serve tea on, which you would sit on cushions next to. And the routine would always be the same. I'd come back home and say, and there'd be some random people sitting there.
Okay, so you're coming home and there's all these people saying, hey, you know, come talk to us or whatever. But you had just come to China, right? So, I mean, what were you doing at this point to, like, learn the language? Obviously, you had exposure, but, like, what were you doing and how were you progressing?
We had class every morning from 8 to 12, and then usually in the afternoon I had nothing. So if it wasn't back to the flat or seeing some of these random people that I'd bumped into, I'd just go out over town on my bike and just ride around in various directions. But, you know, things were just happening all the time. I got taken along to various art events or people trying to be as radical as possible. I guess it was just being put into that environment where there was enough stuff happening that I always had reasons to want to learn. So I found myself doing flashcards, making them just from things I was interested in, first of all. And then later on, I was sort of annoyed that I couldn't read everything in Hong Kong after a trip there. So I started doing them for complex characters as well.
Can you think of any times where you, like, kind of had, like, a real breakthrough?
Close to the beginning, you know, somebody with not much vocabulary, somebody with not much grammar, and just realizing that I'd solved a problem like a baby would, which was the word if. I didn't know a word for if at the time. So you can think this is just a few weeks' worth of Chinese, but I decided to just do it by tone of voice. 你去,我也去. And it turned out that that's a perfectly acceptable way to transmit the idea of if.
Huh.
And it just turned me into an optimist, I guess.
That's pretty cool. So you were able to like almost experiment and you had a success. So I assume you spent about a year, this first year in Beijing, you know, studying Chinese. I mean, where did you end up after that?
All right, that was the first time around living there. And after that, I went back to Brussels.
Well, real quick, William, where did you grow up at?
I grew up in Brussels. I went to boarding schools in Britain for some time, but Brussels is where I grew up in an English-speaking family. And then, another stroke of luck, they just created this embassy job out of nothing from one day to the next. The European Union's embassy in Beijing decided that they were going to have their own interpreter. And they created the job, and bureaucratically speaking, if you're an embassy, you can either create a diplomat's job, where it's somebody who is already in your employ and comes over for 4 years or so and then goes back, or a local hire, where it has to be a Chinese national, or, and there's one category in between, which is now called a contract agent. And they decided to create it as this in-between category. So it had to be a foreign national, and they decided that it had to be a European Union citizen. And they'd been trying to find a European Union citizen who was in any way qualified to do this, and they couldn't find anyone. So instead, they chose me after a brief interview and tests that were run by interpreters, but they just tested for sort of aptitude to become an interpreter.
Oh, really?
And so it just happened, and I got the chance to move back. And really, I didn't know much about the profession at all. I just wanted to move back to Beijing again. And if I had diplomatic immunity, so much the better.
I mean, that's really interesting. So you get hired to be an interpreter, but you'd only studied Chinese for like a year. But I imagine, how was your Chinese at that point when you were actually hired to be an interpreter?
Well, I could get more or less any concept across. I couldn't necessarily do it in the correct register a lot of the time. And I didn't know how to prepare properly or deal with sort of random difficult situations that were thrown at me. And that didn't turn out to be too much of a problem because the sort of meetings that I did in this organization tended to be about the same group of things. I mean, if it wasn't trade, it was agriculture. And if it wasn't agriculture, it was occasionally politics, maybe a bit of science thrown in. But it tended to be the same ongoing things. I had quite a lot of imposter syndrome as well. But that was assuaged a bit by the fact that most of the time, the other interpreter sitting across from the table in whatever ministry we'd be going to was also untrained.
Oh, interesting.
They would be somebody who was at that ministry, usually pretty young, and happened to have, you know, spent a few years abroad or done English at university. So we're basically in the same boat to begin with. But I did keep getting imposter syndrome when I came up against actual trained interpreters. So I decided eventually to deal with that and actually do some proper training. You know, imposter syndrome and just general nerves at the beginning went to the point that, you know, I would actually have my hands sweating on the way to various meetings that I'd be interpreting. And then you would occasionally have major politicians flying in and going to see some of the top leaders and really trying to make the most of their 3 or 4 days in town, maybe go outside Beijing as well. But sort of youngish, nervous at the time, you could make silly mistakes. Mistakes like getting onto the wrong minibus at the end of one meeting, because you were just thinking, oh, but then you get onto the wrong minibus and you realize that this minibus is not actually taking you to the next meeting. It's taking you back to the embassy, and you realize, uh-oh. And what that meant in this case was that I had to ask to get out of the minibus halfway along and rush by metro, which I thought would be fastest, to the Ministry of Public Security on Chang'anjie, and then try and talk my way into the Ministry of Public Security by saying that, oh, this is a real emergency. There's people meeting the minister in there right now, and I'm supposed to be in that room too. Now, come on, I don't have time for any of this. I have to go in right now.
Just let me in, right? What were you doing at this stage also to kind of like improve your Chinese?
I tried to do a couple of silly things. My first few months on the job, I decided, maybe now's the time to subscribe to the People's Daily. And, you know, these would just pile up on my desk. And it wasn't quite the right time. Say what you like about the People's Daily, but it's not really written to be readable. It's written for other purposes, and some of which are very worthy of study if you follow certain people online, like Bill Bishop. but that wasn't a good idea. So I cancelled that after a couple of months. And something that worked a little bit better was subscribing to a tabloid at home. So at the time, there was a company called Xiao Hong Mao, Little Red Riding Hood, and they started off delivering fresh milk every morning, but they very quickly added newspapers to their offering. So I subscribed to Beijing Youth Daily, which was more of a tabloid. Mm. And that had quite a lot more readable stuff, you know, the more gossipy stuff. And they were running a campaign at one point against topless men on the streets of Beijing, which was the Bar Year campaign. There's no really good way to translate Bar Year. Maybe like you fat bastard or something. It's completely unethical by today's standards. They were just taking photos of people on the streets of Beijing and shaming them by putting them in the newspaper and then giving them a t-shirt saying, Liang Li Beijing, you wo yi ge. I am one of the faces of beautiful Beijing, after putting on this t-shirt and covering myself up. So they'd have funny things like that in the paper just to keep my interest going. But I didn't really have anyone sharing interesting things, you know, fiction, novels, to read in Chinese until I read about a couple of controversial authors. And I thought, ah, maybe I'll read that. And that turned out a lot better. And this was, again, 2002, 2003. Much later on in my life, I ended up in a nearly 10-year marriage to one of these authors.
Wow.
But it was sort of an entry point.
So what's different then about interpreting school as opposed to maybe a general language school? For me, previously, before ever having moved to China, I'd never been exposed to any like simultaneous interpretation, SI. Maybe you could, you know, pull back the curtain for us.
Right. Well, it involves quite a bit of unlearning if you've ever done any interpreting beforehand. You, first of all, get told not to do certain things that you've probably been doing. For example, taking notes. You stop taking notes and just start listening. The first thing that you are supposed to learn is how to listen in such a way that you can use just the structure of what somebody's been saying for up to 5 minutes to give a pretty good rendition of their story. But in order to do that well, you need to listen actively to not just the words somebody's saying, but why they're saying it, where they're going with this, and just make that something that you instinctively do. I mean, it's something that a lot of people will do when retelling jokes. They will be constantly thinking about the point of the joke in order to be able to retell it. But they don't do it with other types of material. And after that, they will give you your pen back after about 3 months.
Hmm.
And then you experiment, and there's a lot of trial and error with how to take notes properly so you can interpret consecutively, which is how, by the way, most political meetings in Beijing are interpreted. The person that you might see sitting next to or behind the politicians in the photo taking notes is usually an interpreter. Then after about a year or so, you again go back to basics to prepare to interpret simultaneously. And you start off, again, without interpreting. You start off just practicing the act of listening to something and talking at the same time. You start off in the same language. You might listen to something in English and just shadow it. You know, just say what the people are saying as you listen to it, you know, as if maybe you're on a tour bus with a relative who's hard of hearing. So you're relaying everything that the guide is saying to them about the city of Liverpool. And then after a while, you do it in the other language, but working just in that language. And then you try to not use the same words, but to paraphrase. And then after a while, you transition, and it still takes a lot of getting used to it, you transition into relaying it in a different language as you listen. It takes a lot of getting used to.
So what was the hardest aspect of all that for you?
The hardest aspect was actually something that's now taught as a separate subject, which is simultaneous with text, which is when somebody is doing a speech from a pre-prepared text, which has hopefully been shared with you, and hopefully not 30 seconds before they start speaking. So there are various ways to go through that text and mark it up. I mean, you're not going to have time to write down a translation of the whole thing. And then you have to somehow try and keep up with them as they whiz through this thing. And make sense and not really lose any of the information. Now, that is truly hard for somebody who has not gone to school in both of those languages, because then you don't have quite the same speed reading skills that you would, say, as a law student going through a 25-page judgment to find the one or two interesting points.
That's interesting to me. You bring up the speed of reading, because this is something I talk about a lot with learners, is that reading speed is one of the best indicators of progress and fluency in a language. But you're pointing out here is that, hey, sometimes maybe your reading speed doesn't quite match the presenter.
The same happens in English, by the way, when somebody's at a conference and they're nervous. They've got their text in front of them, but the more nervous they are, the faster they tend to go. And speakers at academic conferences who don't usually sit on that podium, for example, so they just want to read out their paper, but they don't really want to be there at all, so they kind of want to get out of there as soon as they can.
Mm-hmm.
They go really, really fast. And apart from the technique, you do need to be able to push yourself very, very hard to just jump along. You're not going to be able to follow it in a very, very detailed way, but just to keep jumping along with them and just force yourself to keep pace.
So essentially, from what I understand, what you're saying is that if you were just to hear someone give a speech, it would be easier to interpret that as opposed to someone giving a speech and you have the text of their speech in front of you. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, if they're speaking ad lib, if they're speaking off the cuff, it is much, much easier. You will see them, they'll come over completely differently visually. They'll look much more engaged usually. And it's just a lot easier because you're getting the ideas, you're getting the content at the same speed as that which they are coming up with it.
Mm.
Kind of the speed at which the human brain naturally works. Whereas if it's, I mean, the extreme example would be somebody reading out from the phone book. If it's scripted, it does tend to be quite a lot more dense. And by the way, there's not much point in speeches like that because the audience isn't going to remember half of the figures and facts that they're quoting unless you give them some pre-printed handouts as well.
So what are some of the most challenging scenarios that you've encountered as an interpreter?
Physically challenging is, for example, being in a new model of car, which happened to be a very, very sporty variant, on a racetrack. Because this particular car manufacturer wanted to get journalists from all over the world to come and test drive this new, very sporty, very fast vehicle. And they laid on a racetrack for it, and they had a whole line of these very fast cars. And at the front, they had a professional race driver. And in the cars behind, you had one or two journalists from motoring publications, usually from China, and everybody had signed health and safety waivers. Everybody was wearing a bit of protective equipment.
Mm-hmm.
But then my job was to interpret over walkie-talkie with the professional race car driver telling them when to brake and when to turn hard to the right, hard to the left, and so on. And we've got a huge bend coming up here, but you can't see it as we're coming up to it, but we're going to be going right down to the run. So you want to brake hard and stay right over to the left here. So if you mess that up,
yeah,
then the consequences could be quite severe. But at the same time, it's also you are physically on a roller coaster anyway. But interestingly, you sort of stop noticing that. You stop noticing the fact that you were on this, you know, sitting in a vehicle driven by a racing driver, you know, because you're busy interpreting.
That's kind of funny. I can imagine there's got to be some other experiences too, or maybe not like the physical aspect, but maybe just the situation or something.
Yeah, there's a couple, like being inside a pharmaceutical manufacturing plant where, you know, you have to change out of all of your clothes and go through two or three changing rooms, in each of which you put on a new disposable surgical gown. And then eventually you get into the drug plant, but you're still not let into the area where the people are actually moving the drug substance itself around. You can look through the window and they all look like astronauts in there for all the protective clothing that they're wearing. But the reason that I was in there was because these plants need to be inspected if they're exporting to major markets. And so the job was to walk around asking very, very difficult questions about every single tiny little bit and hygiene precautions and records and what's in that fridge.
Mm, I see. I also want to hear from your experience, the difference between simultaneous interpretation, which is oral, verbal, versus translation, right, where we're translating written documents.
There's a bit of crossover between the two professions, but not that much. The subject matter in written translation, the sort that interpreters end up doing, that is, tends usually to be less interesting. And the exception has really been, over the years, modern art, actually. There's a lot of work that continues to come through from a very vibrant modern art sector, and they need people who are able to somehow render stuff that curators are writing into English or into Chinese. The difficult people to translate, by the way, are not artists. They're the people who write about artists. They're the people who put the exhibitions together. They're the sort of clergy, if you like, of the art world. So they're the ones who are pulling out all these obscure references left, right, and center. Artists tend to just say, what I was doing with this painting was, well, basically I've got this friend, but I was on a trip to Cuba, and yeah, I just found it interesting because I'd see all these people in Cuba and they were like this, and you know, the artists tend to be quite easy to interpret.
Yeah.
But translation as a whole is also, it's kind of divided into two. The stuff that people really want to do is literary translation.
Mm-hmm.
And there you have to be able to write poetry, you have to be able to write prose like that in your native language. And I don't think I'm capable of actually writing a novel in English, so I would shy away from that. It has also tended to be not very well paid, particularly when people are translating fiction into Chinese, where publishing houses have often just gone for the person who puts in the lowered bid, regardless, because they've already got the rights to that title.
Mm-hmm.
And who cares? I'm sure there are exceptions, but that's maybe also one thing that I would say to myself in retrospect from learning Chinese. Don't buy translations of authors in other languages to read.
Why is that?
If you think to yourself, oh, I really wanted to read Milan Kundera someday, but it would be good if I read it in Chinese instead. Mm. That would be good for me. Well, actually, it probably won't be, or it's very likely not to be. In Taiwan, the translations are done in a quite different way. And to my mind, they're done often a lot better. So there's a couple of authors that I read who write in languages that I don't understand. But if I can get hold of a Taiwan translation of one of their works, I'll buy it.
They'd take more care on the translation, or it's a result of an unregulated market?
I guess the market just works differently, or it's more professionalized as a whole. And it's interesting also that there always is a different Taiwan version, and there's an exact parallel with English. I don't know how many times you've picked up a novel in English and turned it over, and it's got the prices on the back, and it says, for copyright reasons, this book is not for sale in the USA.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen
that. And then you might thought, what the hell? And that's actually because there are two English languages in publishing. So they will sell the rights for the American English edition of the book, and they'll also sell the rights for the British English version of the book, which is also sold in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and possibly India.
I remember once back when Harry Potter was big, I was in England and I brought home a copy of Harry Potter from my brother, and it was like different than the American version. He was like, wow, this is unique.
Yeah. Well, there's something that's been written in English in the first place. And if it's translated into English, they tend to use the same translation, but it's two sets of rights.
Yeah.
And in Chinese terms, you have the rights for the translation into traditional Chinese and the translation into simplified Chinese, and they will end up being two different books. They'll end up being translated by two different people.
Wow, that is fascinating. That's really interesting. I was unaware of that. So, William, you haven't spent your whole time in China. I mean, you're in Berlin now. So what made that transition for you, saying, hey, I'm going to leave China, I'm going to move to Germany?
I moved from Beijing to Berlin in 2015, and that was together with my ex-wife, and both of us wanted to do something new. She wanted to do something new creatively as well, and we both moved here, and then various other things happened. But it's turned out to be about as good a place as any to be based in Europe as somebody who interprets with Chinese.
Well, what kind of opportunities have you had to interpret while you've been there in Germany, or I guess in Europe in general?
If I could mention one thing, it's been the Berlin Film Festival, the Berlinale, which happens every year, every February,
mm-hmm.
when the city's still pretty cold. And that often clashes with Chinese New Year, but people come anyway. people do come and it's prestigious. People want their film to be in competition, in the running for a Silver Bear or two, or even the Golden Bear. And that's led to working with and sometimes being on a stage with a few people from Chinese film circles. And that is really what tests if you have stage fright or not, because you're then in a situation where you're not only trying to relay somebody's joke, but do it in front of 400 to 500 people if it's a premiere. And you're getting instant feedback, you know, whether people laugh or not. And the person that you're interpreting for is sometimes nervous as well. So they will sometimes try to make you part of the joke or just do a little run-in saying, oh, hi, my English is not that good. So, hey, William, help me. You know, there's always things that you can't keep up with. You know, I try as much as possible to follow things that are happening in mainland China and other Chinese-speaking parts of the world, but there's always things you're going to miss. So I missed the fact that one particular cast member of one film who had come to Berlin with his director and a couple of other cast members was actually a boy band singer as well.
Oh.
And so you would actually have teenage fans of his waiting at every street corner just to catch sight of this guy. And they'd be arriving late at their own red carpet premiere because of that. And so hundreds and hundreds of teenage fans, some of whom might even have traveled from Asia just for this. And I had no idea who this person was. I'm just an interpreter, you know?
Yeah, but you can't catch it all, that's for sure. How do you handle jokes like that?
It's a good question. And, you know, I've often wondered if it's a particular thing that you have, maybe just trying to build a rapport with the audience some way. You know, if you try and deliver it in a somewhat whimsical manner or just make it very, very clear that it's meant in a humorous way. And it's not so much about interpreting, it's about being able to improvise on the spot just with one particular line. So being able to sort of interact with the audience, being able to read them, which has usually got me through it. I can't think of many examples where the joke has completely fallen flat. I've had more trouble actually where people are making jokes about each other or making a joke about something and not realizing that this is going to cause serious offense to the other person. But then, you know, your job is to interpret that joke, even though it's going to cause them serious offense, because otherwise you're just going to be asked, hey, why did you censor that bit? I didn't know that they said that. That was shocking when my colleague told me afterwards.
A little awkward, right? But hey, you got to do your job, right? Yep.
You have to do the job, yeah. And who knows what's going on, what people are actually trying to do tactically. They may, at one point, actually want to cause offense. You just don't know, because politics works in different ways. It moves in mysterious ways.
I appreciate you sharing that, because I remember one of my early days in Shanghai, I had a friend of mine who was helping me translate some stuff. And he would sit there and he'd listen, he had almost like having a conversation with the other guy. And I'm like, what's going on? What's he saying? You know? And then he like give me like a few sentences and he like negotiated a whole bunch of stuff and I or something. And I was like, no, that's not what I want. I wanted you to be able to tell me what's happening so I can make the decision and then tell you what I want you to say. And so I think there are some people that miss that, right? I think as interpreting, you're not there to evaluate, censor, or whatever. You're there to communicate, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you can try to read where somebody's coming from, but you won't always get it. You won't always get what they're doing or why they're doing it. They may actually be saying things more with a view to the media that are also there, even though it sounds like the most ridiculous thing you'd want to say at that point. You just don't know.
Well, William, if you could go back and give some advice to a younger William, what would that advice be, or what would you do differently?
I would just say that this is as much about living in Beijing or Shanghai as about learning Chinese. I just say that it is actually important to try and develop various hobbies where you end up with a circle of male friends. That tends to be a lot harder to do otherwise than places you may be used to living in. And I was impressed to listen to Matt Sheehan talking about his ultimate frisbee, for example, that gave him, I guess, a ready, large-ish social circle of Chinese-speaking frisbee players, for example. I should have done stuff like that. never mind what sport it was. You know, there was a friend who kept asking me to go to field hockey, but I never did. I should have done.
Hmm. Maybe you could have been a lead singer in a band back in the punk scene, right?
Well, I've seen people try to do that, and you know, the results vary. And that also touches on one of my pet peeves, actually. You're more of a Shanghai fan anyway, so you don't particularly like Er Huai Yin, I assume.
Yeah, ending, that's right.
Ending particular syllables with er. But the one thing that really gets my goat is when people do it wrong, when people do it on the wrong syllable.
Mm.
And people will usually do it when they're trying to show off, whether they are trying to demonstrate familiarity with Beijing in a metro and they end up saying, the next station is Xijimer, which is just wrong, and that's horribly wrong. You just don't say that. Or if they're on stage and trying to sound as punk as possible in their non-native language, and ending almost every word with Er Huai Yin, you know, it grates after a while. So I'll stick to the bass playing. You've got to just remember not to do it until it comes naturally. I mean, apparently I do it, but it's suddenly I don't notice it while I'm doing it.
Well, last thing, William, what advice would you give to someone who's learning Chinese right now?
I'd say just find a way that helps you to lose a few of the inhibitions you have. You're not going to lose all of them. And in non-pandemic times, that could be something like just making yourself go backpacking or spend time in cities that aren't as large as Beijing, Shanghai, or Guangzhou, where it really is possible to get by without much Chinese at all. Spend time where you are forced to find solutions, where you need to find out when the next bus is coming and where it's going, or when you need to change a light bulb or whatever. Just put yourself in difficult situations. I mean, I've heard other people interviewed who've said that it's not possible to learn like a baby. And you've spent a lot of time discussing that on the podcast. And I've just found various times where I have been a bit more like a baby and a bit less inhibited. And I found that those have been the most useful and fruitful times that I've had when I've been on the road or dealing with a burst water pipe, learning to fix things myself, and just dealing with people when I have no other choice. And that's from the point of view of somebody who's a bit of an introvert, but knows that he has to put himself in these situations.
Words of wisdom from a man who knows. William, I really appreciate you taking the time with us.
No problem.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, traveler, wrangler, athlete, zoologist, curator, social worker, teacher, and that one pal named Pat. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at mannercompanion.com. Apologies, John Cena. We just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is Kaiser Guo at SubChina, and our interview editor is James Harper with Filter Productions. I'd like to thank our guest, William White, and of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Pasden. See you next time.